We come now, brothers and sisters, to consider events which obviously affect us all in the sense that they affect our salvation. But I would suggest that they also should affect us all in the sense that these events which we consider both today and tomorrow, God willing, should reach deep into our hearts. We should be moved by these things which we read and upon which we think. Brother Alan, a few minutes ago, brought us to Gethsemane. And it is to Gethsemane that we go in Matthew and chapter 26. In Matthew 26 and in verse 36, then cometh Jesus with them unto a place called Gethsemane. In John's record in chapter 18, he tells us that in so doing he crossed the Kidron. And Kidron means dusky, but it's from a root meaning dark coloured and hence to mourn. I'm sure that point wouldn't be missed upon the Master. Luke's record in chapter 22 and verse 39 adds the point, as he was wont. And that, of course, is the important clue as far as the betrayal is concerned. Jesus himself makes the point that he'd been preaching openly for many days. Why suddenly should they come to him at night? And the whole point was, of course, they wanted this thing done out of sight of the people who believed that he was indeed their Messiah. And so Judas knew that it was his want, and so Judas took a fair guess that that's where he would be when he brought the soldiers to him. However, more of that anon, God willing. So he went to Gethsemane. Gethsemane means an oil press. And how appropriate it is for we think of the pressure which is being brought to bear in order to extract the oil. And if ever there was a man under pressure, surely this was it. We talk of pressure and of stress today, but here was a man upon whom the salvation of all the chosen of his Father now depended. And he had a great work to do. Not just, if I can use that expression, as he hung upon the accursed tree, but now, during the course of the next few hours in the garden. And the oil that was pressed in the under the law, and I'm thinking of Exodus 27 and verse 20, was so that the light should always burn. And that, of course, is so appropriate for he who was the light of the world. And he took with him, in verse 37, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee. Those who had been with him at the transfiguration, they had been with him at the healing of Jairus' daughter, they, together with Andrew, had been with him where he had gave them a personal prophecy, if you like, to do with AD 70. And now here they are with him in Gethsemane. So this group of three in particular are obviously very close to the Master. And we shall see he gives them a special task to undertake. And the reason that he wanted these with him was, we're still in verse 37, that he began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Sorrowful means exactly that, distressed. And the word "and" might better be rendered "even." So he was sorrowful or distressed, even very heavy. And that word is the most powerful of three words used in the New Testament to indicate distress or sorrow or depression. This is the very worst, most intense case. So he was sorrowful, even very distressed, for want of a word. And so he tells them, "My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death." It's difficult to be in any sense precise as to what time of day or night this was, except of course we know it was after the supper. We know they had their supper. We know the discourse through John 15, 16, 17 has taken place. We know they've gone through the city and across the valley. So it's reasonable to suppose it might be somewhere around, I don't know, 11 o'clock, maybe even midnight. And yet, his death would not come until 3 o'clock the following afternoon. So when he says sorrowful even unto death, he is perhaps thinking of 15, 16, 17 hours of knowing what was to befall him and knowing the events that would take place, not just his death, again if we can use that expression, but the terrible events prior to it. So no wonder then we read he was exceeding sorrowful even unto death. And so he gives the disciples an instruction. Before we come on to that, Mark in his record says that Jesus began to be sore amazed, which doesn't give us really perhaps the true meaning. There was nothing to be amazed about, but it is a word which can mean terrified, and we shall see particularly tomorrow, God willing, what he was going to go through. And any human being would be terrified at such a thought. Could we have the first overhead, please, Brother Luke? Thank you. We've tried to put together a chronology of the events as recorded by Matthew and Luke, the events to do with the actual garden itself. In simple terms, Luke seems to deal with earlier events and Matthew seems to deal with later events, and then they come together right at the end with, "While he yet spake, the soldiers came." But for the moment we're in Matthew. I'm not going to go through that, you'll just see it there as we speak. So we're in Matthew, and in Matthew chapter 26 still, and verse 38, we read there at the end of the verse, "Tarry ye here and watch with me." Now that word "watch," as it often does in the New Testament, means to stay awake. Now bear in mind, this was the end of a long evening. They'd had supper, they'd had a glass or two of wine, and the natural thing is to fall asleep. But he specifically says, "Watch, stay awake, stay alert with me." And notice he's not saying watch in the sense of place a guard, for he knew that the soldiers were coming, but that isn't what he says. It's not watch for me, it's watch with me. Stay awake with me. Those disciples that were particularly close, and I would suggest what he's asking for is what we might call today moral support. He was going to go away from them, we see in verse 39, a little further. The other gospel records tell us it was a stone's throw. So it was obviously night time. Plainly there were no street lamps. It was a stone's throw away. So he would be out of earshot and quite possibly out of any definite form of sight. Maybe a hazy shadow at best. In other words, he would now be on his own. But he wanted to know that a few paces away there were those who were close to with him who were awake. He was of course to be disappointed, but nevertheless that was the instruction. We turn now to Luke's record, because he provides us with the second instruction that they were given. Not only were they to watch, but Luke records for us in verse 40 of chapter 22. Luke 22 verse 40. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. And again, the word doesn't quite do, the translation doesn't quite do justice. There was no temptation in that sense of the word for them to fall into. But when we read the concordance, it tells us the word temptation is to put to proof or to experience evil or provocation or adversity. Now, he knew that he had to go through all of those things. And of course, we see in John 18 that he held the soldiers at bay while the disciples escaped. And that perhaps was an answer to the prayer, which if they followed their instructions, they would have offered. So they were to stay awake and they were to pray that they might suffer, not in effect, not suffer as he was going to do. And so now then he was on his own. And in verse 41 of Luke 22, we read he was withdrawn from them, a stone's cast, and he kneeled down and prayed. And I don't think that we can over-exaggerate either the intensity or indeed the time taken for this prayer. We have the words before us, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. And it takes perhaps 2 or 3 seconds. I strongly suspect, brethren and sisters, it took far longer than that, for reasons which we shall see in a moment. But let's just stay with this prayer as we have it here before us. Father, if thou be willing. He put the will of the Father first. But nevertheless, he had a will of his own, which came from the flesh. But he kept that in subjection. But more of that in a moment. What did he actually say? Remove this cup from me. And I've been aware of brethren who have tried to, in effect, water that down. He wasn't really praying for it to be removed. He was. There's no doubt as to what the word means. It means to carry off. Can we go to Jude and chapter 1? Well, it would be chapter 1, wouldn't it? But Jude and verse 12. Jude and verse 12. And it's the same Greek word that we're going to read, where we have, these are spots in your feast of charity when they feast with you, feeding themselves without fear. Clouds are they without water, carried about of winds. And it's that expression, carried about. We all know what clouds are. We all know what the wind does. It removes them, moves the clouds from one place to another. A cloud which is in wind does not stay still. It goes. And it's the same Greek word here, remove. So there was no doubt that he was praying for the cup to be removed. We should come back to Luke, but can we turn please to Psalm 69? Psalm 69, and think of these first three verses in the context of Jesus on his knees in the garden, in the darkness, on his own, praying. We know that this psalm was on his mind because of the first verse, save me, O God. What from? For the waters are come into my soul, I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. Now that mire, if you just glance at verse 14, is a figure for his enemies. He knows he's going to be surrounded by enemies, and the feeling is of that of sinking, of drowning. Verse 3, I am weary of my crying. Imagine him there in the garden. I am weary of my crying. And the word crying is to call out or to call by name. Father, let this cup pass from me. My throat is dried. My eyes fail while I wait for my God. That prayer, brethren and sisters, did not take 2 or 3 seconds. It lasted for a while. It was deep. It was intense, as any prayer has ever been. So we come back into Luke 22. Can we move on to the next overhead, please, Brother Luke? Nevertheless, we read, not my will, but thine be done. And we saw a verse which I'd never thought of in this context only a few minutes ago with Brother Alan. I'm not going to turn to it, but it was 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5, where we read, bring into captivity every thought to obedience. The verse goes on to say obedience of Christ, but we can see how it applies to Christ. Bring every thought into captivity to obedience. And that was what the Master did. Those thoughts which were prompted by the nature which he bore were not of themselves a sin. He brought them immediately into captivity, into obedience. Not my will, but thine be done. But he had a will, brethren and sisters. And if he didn't have a will, which came from the flesh, there was nothing for him to overcome. And so we simply make the case that that which is born of flesh is flesh, as was Christ. He was tempted like as we are, yet without sin. And surely Hebrews 5 has to mean something. He learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And I would submit that he'd not learn by the suffering upon the accursed tree. He learned by the suffering, in particular, in Gethsemane. And what he learned was that he could overcome the flesh. But he suffered in so doing. Or to use the terminology of James chapter 1 and verse 15, lust, which simply means longing, in his case, did not conceive. It was there, but he did not conceive, and therefore did not bring forth sin. And in Matthew 26 and verse 53, Jesus makes a point where he says, know ye not that I could presently pray to my Father and he would send me 12 legions of angels? He could have prayed for 6,000 angels and they would have been sent. There's temptation. All that was needed, of course, was one. Would still have taken him out of that situation. What temptation is that? But he did not succumb to it, and an angel came to him and strengthened him. We're in verse 43 now of Luke 22. There appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. And I would suggest that that is the answer to his prayer. Can this cup remove? Not my will but thine. The answer is no, but I can help. And the help was an angel from heaven strengthening him. That word strengthening only comes in one other place in Scripture. It means to invigorate. It comes also in Acts chapter 9 and verse 19, where Saul, who was to become the Apostle Paul, after his experience on the road to Damascus, we read that he took meat and was strengthened. So the strengthening there was a physical strengthening. So was it the case then that even at this point in this process, the Master was so physically drained, certainly mentally drained, that he needed to be sustained by an angel. What the Father knew, of course, was that the disciples had fallen asleep. They were not going to be any help. And so we read that an angel came from heaven. That's not a very common expression. We're not going to look at the occurrences, but an angel from heaven. And I would suggest that that's an inference that this was the response to his prayer. The prayer, of course, rose to his Father in heaven, and an angel was dispatched by way of response. And so into verse 44. Being in an agony. It only occurs here, and it means to struggle or to anguish. And it's a struggle or an anguish which no other man has ever undertaken. So it's appropriate that it should be a unique term. No man has struggled like this. And that's perhaps an academic point. But let's re-emphasise what we've implied before. There was a struggle. And he simply had to overcome those promptings of the flesh. And so, being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat was, it were, great drops of blood. And what we went on to say, or should have gone on to say, was that that word agony comes from a root meaning a place of contest. And we can all think of scriptures that talk about sin and the spirit being at enmity and in contest in Romans 7. All of these things going on now in the mind and in the body of the Master. So being in an agony then, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood. The first blood that was ever shed was, of course, that of Abel's. And there is a parallel. A law-abiding man was murdered by someone who wanted to change the law for himself. We can see in very simple terms the parallel with what was going to happen with the Master. And he sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. The way the Authorised Version reads it, it's an accurate translation. The emphasis, I believe, is upon the word great. The drops of blood, very simply, is that word from which we get our word thrombosis. And taken literally, it means clots of blood. But I don't think that's the point. It's the emphasis is on the great drops of blood, and therefore we imagine the great beads of sweat. And we say sweat because we've read accounts of how it is possible, I believe, under great stress, for a man's blood to come through his skin. And I would suggest that is not relevant. We are not told here of Christ's blood. The word says his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood. It doesn't say it was blood. It's as it were blood. So we're concentrating then upon the sweat. Could we move on to the next one, please, Brother Luke? Let's think then of great drops of blood and the sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. And let's follow this line of thinking. Where does sweat come from in Scripture, first of all? Genesis, of course, chapter 3 and in verse 19. And what's the context? It's the punishment for sin. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. Think of that expression, eat bread. And in John chapter 4 and verse 34, Christ says, my meat, to eat his bread, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. And we shall see in a moment that tomorrow, God willing, he says, it is finished. And in Matthew 26 and verse 29, he said that he would no more eat of the fruit of the vine until he drank it anew with them in the kingdom. Now, what's the relevance of that? He suggested before that he was the high priest now, about to go about his priestly duty. And the first occurrence that we can find in Scripture of blood being poured out upon the earth is in Exodus 29 and verse 12. I know Abel's blood was shed, but the Scripture doesn't say specifically it was poured out, although obviously it was. But the first reference as such to blood poured out is Exodus 29 and verse 12, the blood poured at the bottom of the altar, which was the consecration of the priests. Here again we see the connection with the priest. And Exodus 39 and verse 30, upon Aaron's head, upon that plate which was upon his head, upon the mitre, was the expression, holiness unto Yahweh. And it was upon his head, of course. And by the sweat of thy brow shalt thou eat bread. So we've almost come full circle then in our thinking. All of these things then, I believe, are implied here in Luke 22 and verse 44. And that's why I would suggest the expression is, as it were, great drops of blood. Otherwise, it's actually a very strange expression. But it ties in, I think, with the blood at the base of the altar. Falling to the ground. So in verse 45 then, when he rose up from prayer and was come to his disciples, he found them sleeping for sorrow. I think, Brother Luke, if we could put the first one back on, it might help, the one with the blue one. He found them sleeping for sorrow. And at first, that may seem strange. Why were they asleep when they'd been asked to stay awake? Well, I would suggest it is quite simply, as Christ says later on, the spirit was willing but the flesh was weak. But what of this expression, sleeping for sorrow? The word for would better be translated away from. Now remember, they were away from Christ by a stone's cast. So they weren't actually close to him to witness this sweat, as it were, being great drops of blood. They didn't witness the intensity of what was going on. They were distant from it. And the sorrow, I believe, we won't turn to it now, but in Matthew 26 and verse 38, Jesus uses the same word of himself. I think it's where he says, I'm exceeding sorrowful. And it's the same word. So where we read, he found them sleeping for sorrow, I think it's his sorrow, and we're simply being told that they were being distant from his sorrow, both physically and mentally. And so he again goes on to say, why sleep ye? Rise and pray, that ye enter not into temptation. And as you glance down the overhead, we're not going to look at these now in any great detail, except to say, can we go back to Matthew 26 and verse 40? Here's another reason, I believe, that these events took time. Verse 40 of Matthew 26, and he cometh to the disciples, and finding them sleeping, and saith unto Peter, what could ye not watch with me 1 hour? And that's the normal word for an hour. And because Jesus says 1 hour, I would suggest that's not a general period of time. The inference, at least, is that he means something as we understand the term, an hour. Whether it was literally absolutely 60 minutes is another matter altogether. But I'm trying to say that it was a long period of time. It was not over in a few seconds. And we mustn't gloss over this, brethren and sisters, because this is Christ overcoming the flesh for himself and for us. It's deep, it's intense, it's personal, it's vital. But they had fallen asleep. And yes, this is where he says, the Spirit indeed is willing. So there wasn't a criticism. The Spirit was willing, but the flesh is weak. And so he goes away again and prays. And then, still in Matthew, we move on to verse 43 now. And he came and found them asleep again. So he's gone away and prayed again. And he finds them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. This time there was no instruction. He left them and went away. And he prayed the third time, saying the same words. Then cometh he to the disciples and saith unto them, sleep on now and take your rest. Behold, the hour is at hand, the Son of Man is betrayed. Now the way the gospel records read, that he'd no sooner said that, and certainly Luke goes on to say, rise up, and it seems rather strange that he would on one hand say, rest now, and then the next minute, well, up he gets. And I would suggest, therefore, there was time. After Matthew 26 and verse 45, he allows them to sleep on. We're not told what he was doing. I would suggest that now he knows he has overcome. His mind is now set. There are no more prayers of that nature, at least, to be offered. That work of overcoming the flesh has been completed in his own mind. He still has to go through with it physically. But that battle of the mind, which we all know is by far the more difficult, has now been won. And so he allows them time. He doesn't need their moral support anymore for rest. And so Matthew 26 and verse 46 then says, arise, let us be going. He is at hand that doth betray me. And while he yet spake. It's Luke's record that attaches the while he yet spake straight on to an instruction to pray and to sleep. And it doesn't make too much sense unless you put in the Matthew record at that point. But I think we can put it together in the form that you can see. So he had won the battle. Can we go to Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18? Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18. For in that he himself hath suffered, being tempted, he is able to succour them that are tempted. It's often the case, isn't it, in our own way, that if we have been through a particular experience, then we are the better suited to assist a brother or sister who is going through the same or similar trials and tribulations. Now, whatever we may suffer, brethren and sisters, it does not match what the Master went through. Because he went through this intense suffering, because of this suffering of overcoming the flesh, because he overcame it, because there was something to overcome, he is able to help us. He therefore understands, although we of course fail day after day. But nevertheless, he is able to succour them that are tempted. And as we read the record of the gospel records and of his particular message to his servants through the apocalypse, and as we read those words which were penned by the apostles, surely we gain that succour when we are in trials and tribulations. Can Can we go to Hebrews 5 and verse 8? Verse 7. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears, specifically Gethsemane, whether any other occasions, we don't know. Strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from or out of death, and was heard in that he feared. Not my will, but thine be done. Though he were a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And being made perfect, he wasn't perfect or complete to start with. This suffering process made him complete. He became the author of eternal salvation unto all them that obey him. And so, brethren and sisters, he obtained redemption. He obtained it for himself, and he obtained it for you and I. And in that intense suffering in the garden, he overcame the flesh and the terrible consequences, the physical consequences of that, God willing, we shall see tomorrow.